We were born without invisible labels on us that say food or lab tool or whatever it is that the others are not so lucky to have escaped. But they're us. They're just like us. We all know that there are probably industry people and even federal agents here, so I want to say welcome. It's perhaps very easy to make fun of the feds. They're usually looking for the wrong people because that's more convenient. That's easier than looking for the other ones. There are the federal agriculture inspectors. One has to mention them. I don't know if you read about the federal agriculture inspector in Utah who went into a restaurant where they served four egg quiches, and she said, you can't do that anymore because the information is that one in every four eggs is infected with salmonella, so you'll have to make three egg quiches from now on. It's a true story. And the manager said, well, what if we throw away from the carton one out of every four eggs? And she said, well, let me check with my supervisor. But that said, I've seen massive changes. I know a woman who used to work for the FBI, who became a Peter Undercover investigator, a federal inspector who blew the whistle on what was happening to animals in laboratories, and I know a former NRA spokesperson who is now a vegan and has written perhaps the best essay I've ever read about why you shouldn't fish. So I don't think we should give up on anyone. I was in San Antonio a little while ago, a few months ago, on what used to be the biggest working cattle ranch in Texas. It is called Black Creek. It's owned by a woman she married, this man Johnson, who headed the Johnson Ranch Syndicate. And it is now a sanctuary for abused cattle. She took me around in the converted jeeps that used to be used to go out and just pick off animals. And they've been converted now as sort of safari jeeps so you can go out and watch the animals just being themselves. And there was a chief ranch hand there who, very tall, lanky Texan, he'd been there about 40 years. He wore a Stetson. He had vegan cowboy boots. And we had a private talk that evening, and he said, I can't tell you some of the things that used to go on here. He said, you know about castration and dehorning and these things, but he said, not only to the cattle, but to the horses, the things we did were horrific. But he said, when this vegan lady came along, I didn't know how it was going to be, but I was willing to give it a shot. And he said, now I can look the cattle in the eye. And he said, it's just a wonderful place to work. And he meant it. Things are changing. I was just writing a book, a chapter for a book this week, and I wanted to talk about vegan weddings. And I found I had this enormous choice of people who had had vegan weddings that I could interview. And I chose Dawn and Chris Pelosi from rural Pennsylvania. They were high school students when they met. They had never met a vegan. Chris was a deer hunter, would go out every season with his grandfather and blow deer away. Dawn went to Penn State one day, and she was in the library. She picked up an issue of Peter's Animal Times, and she read an article on factory farming. And she thought it was very interesting. She took it home and she showed it to Chris. And about a week later, they were sitting down to dinner, and their dog, Keisha, was by their side. They love Keisha. Keisha, they're very protective of her. She was born with a congenital heart defect. And Chris just looked at the chicken leg on his plate, and he said, suddenly he thought, what on earth am I doing? This could be Keisha's leg. And so, of course, they stopped eating animals, and they learned more. He stopped hunting and the whole nine yards, so they're vegan. So I thought I'd put them in the book. I interviewed them and I said, what was the hardest part of having a vegan wedding in rural Pennsylvania? I said, was it that the relatives were clamoring for you to serve meat? And Dawn said, well, no, because we said to them when they brought it up that what kind of people would we be on our wedding day that we would violate our principles? And what kind of guests would they be that, knowing how we feel, they would demand that we serve animals on this special occasion? So I said, okay, was it difficult getting a vegan wedding cake? And they said, no, not at all. We had this banana cream four-layer thing with vanilla frosting. It was easy. So I said, well, help me here. Was there anything that was hard to do for a vegan wedding? And they said, yes. We couldn't find a limousine that didn't have leather seats. But she said it worked out beautifully because we ended up hiring a party bus with plastic seats, and we could put everybody in it. So instead of going separately to the church, the whole family went to the church in this party bus and had a better time than they ever would have. So it's great. It's happening. Anyway, back to veganism. I think it is the most powerful statement that we can make, powerful ethical statement. And today's young people, thank God, are embracing it in such numbers that it is putting all the other generations to shame. People ask me all the time, what does it mean? Do you eat this? Do you eat that? Do you do this? Do you do that? And so I devised what I call is the double S rule. It's very, very simple. Nothing stolen, nothing slaughtered. Milk, it's stolen. Bacon, it's slaughtered. Eggs, stolen. You can have beans and rice and jalapenos and beer, it's okay. But leather, slaughtered. Wool, stolen. Fur, slaughtered. When people put on a fur coat, you know, they have to be standing in their bedroom, living room, whatever. They have to be putting it on and thinking, I look good in this. And the reason they're wearing it is that they hope that people will think well of them, that they'll think they look beautiful. That's why they're putting it on. And when you say something to them, like anything you might say to them, it shatters that illusion. And the next time they go to put it on, they're going to play those audio tapes in their minds of what happened last time, and they're going to be less inclined to wear it. And the reason the double S rule works, I think, is because what kind of person can actually come and argue with you that it's all right to steal and it's all right to slaughter? That's like defending rapes and muggings and murders. One of my favorite quotes is from Dave Allen of the Gang of Four. He said, one day I reached out to eat something and it ran away. Obviously, it didn't want to be eaten. And others of them swim and crawl and fly away. They don't want to be eaten either, and they don't want to have things stolen from them, things that are theirs, that they worked for. Like even the little honey bee who works so hard to make the honey for the hive, that nourishes the hive, that keeps them safe, and we come along and smoke them out and replace it with cheap sugar. We shouldn't do that. In the New York Times magazine a few weeks ago, there was a food writer. He wasn't a vegetarian, but he said he was taken aback when he chopped up one lobster in front of others that were on his kitchen counter. And the others waved their antennae at him and backed away, falling over each other. Cam McQueen, who's a local activist here, wrote that when she went into a restaurant kitchen, a commercial restaurant kitchen, she saw crabs that were covered in batter and left by a boiling pot. One crab had separated himself out from the bunch, and he was trying to move away, even though he couldn't see where he was going because he had batter in his eyes. And she said, at that moment, I realized that all animals want to escape the pot. Several people asked if I would repeat two of the stories I told in Berkeley, and so I will. These are stories that help us, I hope, explain to others why we feel the way we feel. The first story is the truck story, which is about, at this moment, imagining that these doors burst open and into this room come men who are much bigger and much stronger than we are, and with intimidation and cudgels they force us into the center of the room here, and we're very, very frightened, and they're beating up on us, and one of them breaks your nose, and one of them breaks your ribs, and one of them breaks your leg, and you're in pain, and we don't know what's happening, and we are herded into the middle of this room. And they then take us out, and they put us up this ramp onto this truck. And when we're in the truck, we understand that they're going to kill us. There's nothing we can do. They're much bigger and stronger than we are. We're driving along. We're going for hours. We're jostling against each other, trying to stay upright, frightened. And the driver won't talk to us, and we're thirsty, and we can't get anything to drink. And we understand from others who are already on the truck that this is actually happening all over the US right now. There's a whole convoy of trucks. They've started rounding people up from movie theaters and auditoriums and schools and everything, and they're going to kill them. And someone even says they're going to make things out of our skin. And the truck is going along, and it comes to an abrupt stop at a light. And just at that moment, the back of the truck, the door swings open just for a second. And one of us manages to roll out. And then the truck goes on and the door closes permanently. And that one is you. You got away. And the rest of us are looking through the slats. And we're watching you. And we're rooting for you. And you're running. And we see you. You get behind a box or a lamppost or a tree, and you're out of breath, and you're catching your breath, and you get yourself together, and we see you just running, and we're thinking, thank God he got away or she got away. And we know that you are our hope, because you are going to tell the world what's happening, this terrible thing that is happening to us, and you're going to go and get help. And somehow you make it back to your apartment, and you close the door, and you sit there, and you gain your composure, and then you take a shower, and then you put on the TV, and then you call some friends and ask if they'd like to go out, and then you pick up a magazine and you read it, and you forget us. Our hope out the window. And that really is what's happening. Because it's the definition of us. Who are we? It's a silly story, but it's not a silly story, because we are the ones who got away. We are so lucky, whether it's just some cosmic thing or divine intervention, it's just happenstance. We were born without invisible labels on us that say food or lab tool, or whatever it is that the others are not so lucky to have escaped. But they're us. They're just like us. That should be the definition of us. What happens to any animal happens to all of us. The other story is from The Physics of Consciousness. It's about a fellow called Evan Walker. And he writes about a group of mice who sought shelter in his woodshed at the bottom of the garden. And so he was a kind man, is a kind man. And he went out and he bought humane traps. You know, these are the box traps where the animal goes in and the door closes. It doesn't hurt them. So he did that, and then next morning after he'd set them, he went and he found that five of the mice had actually all got into one of the traps together. And they'd become incarcerated there in this tiny space inside the box. Walker says he took the trap down to the driveway and he opened it up in the field next door. Two of the mice, he says, ran off immediately. Of course, they wouldn't know where they were or where they were going. A third had died overnight in the trap. You just have to imagine why or what had happened. A fourth mouse had got his leg caught in the trap mechanism. And he was hanging from it. And a fifth, when he opened the trap, poked his head out and was gasping for breath. And as Walker watched, the mouse, in his fear, went into shock and he died. And Walker wrote this, he said, of this mouse, "His life was a life fully as precious and real to him as ours is to us. terror seized him and extinguished his being and his consciousness, a consciousness as vital as any. This creature, for all the irritation it may have brought as it scampered about through closed closets or up some crack in the wall, was as precious as you or I. He wasn't a machine that breaks and fails. He felt. He had conscious being, and he feared for the loss of it. So intense was his feeling, so large the size of his consciousness, that the terror of these moments took his life away. His was not a small, simple mind. His was consciousness full and real and fragile and precious. Walker comes to the realization that sometimes the selfish things we do or the thoughtless things we do, trying so hard not to inconvenience ourselves, rob others of far greater things, sometimes of every single thing that is precious to them, and that we must be careful, because if we are thinking animals, we need to think about the consequences of everything we do, and that includes little things like saying be quiet when your dog tries to speak when everyone else is speaking, like buying a circus ticket that allows Ringling Brothers to buy the chains that keep a baby elephant locked up for life, or like putting a bit in a horse's mouth so that we can have fun riding. Our work has to be to end these kinds of selfish endeavors. It has to be to destroy the myth that animals are automatons, that they're stupid, that they're inconsequential, and that they're inferior, and that they're unfeeling. And I want to give you some examples about mostly animals that no one considers at all or doesn't wish to consider because it would be inconvenient to consider. Just this last year, there were two important studies about fish. We learned, if we didn't know from common sense, but we learned this year that fish have stable cultural traditions and that they have language among themselves, that they cooperate to find food, that they recognize their shoal mates and like some of them and don't like some of them. We found out that fish experience severe stress and that they rub their lips vigorously on the bottom of their tank in this research study when they've been injected with pepper and other things that make for discomfort. We learned that hens can peck colored switches to turn up the heat or to get food on factory farms, if that's what they have to do. That mussels, tiny mussels, suffer panic attacks when predators come near them, and their hearts beat so fast that they almost burst. That octopuses bang their heads so hard against the walls of their tanks in captivity that they do their brains in, and that they chew off their own tentacles when they're electric shocked because they're so stressed. Fear. I think it's one of the worst things. It's like physical pain. As far back as Darwin, we know that all animals feel fear the same way we do, that a dolphin's teeth actually chatter when she's afraid. The whites of her eyes show when she's afraid. That a frightened gorilla's knees knock. That a dog or a turtle, their sphincters can't hold their urine when they're afraid. In Kenya, rhinoceroses quiver all over when touched by a human being. And baby elephants who've been taken away from their mothers wake up in the night and scream at the memory. They have nightmares. Pigeons perform equally as well as college students in mental imagery tests. Hissing cockroaches can tell human beings apart, and they'll go up to those who've been friendly to them and flee from those who haven't been. Crows can make tools from hooks to retrieve objects through holes in a wall. Cormorants count and keep count as they work. Starlings weave into their nests aromatic plants that fend off mites. Fish can tell time. Monarch butterflies travel all the way from North to South America and back without a compass. Spiders produce webs so strong that our military is trying to learn their secrets. Cows' tongues contain a natural antibiotic which helps heal their wounds. Wood mice use twigs and leaves as markers to find their way back home when they go off into the woods. and big cats use infrasound to warn people to stay away. I don't know how we argue the rather ridiculous arguments of the people who are against veganism. As I say, I don't think they can say we're for slaughter and we're for stealing. But one of the big arguments is that human beings are special, which to me makes no sense at all. I mean, how do you prove that you are special by bullying people who you believe aren't special? I had a job applicant tell me the other day that she thought that the reason we're special is that human beings have a greater capacity for love than any other animals. And I said to her, how do you show your greater capacity for love by showing no love? That's by separating mother cows from their calves or taking baby parrots away from their mothers and selling them in Petco. How can you use the greater capacity to love for love argument to show that we have no hearts at all? And people say, but human intelligence is greater than the animal's intelligence. How do you show our special cleverness by destroying the earth? You know, we are the species that has come along and polluted the riverways and taken down the forests and ruined the topsoil and done all this. The Amazon, billions of animals of all kinds, billions and billions lived in them for millennia and didn't touch it, didn't hurt it. It was a wonderful ecosystem. Homo sapiens goes in there for 5 minutes and poof, the Amazon's as good as gone. You know, animal liberation in all things is human liberation. In the third world, where most leather comes from that you see in the stores here, I've been to the tanneries in places like India, and the toxins from the tanneries are flowing out into the rivers. And those rivers are where the poor people bathe, it's where they wash their clothes. They give that water to their children, and as a result, they get running sores, they get cancer, they get the works. So if our idea of how we help people is to consume, 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 take advantage of developing countries, take advantage of poor people in the third world, and give our own children in the first world epidemics of obesity, then I think that everyone could take a lesson from the animal rights movement. Human slavery. Today we have all animal slavery. Human slavery was wrong, but people wouldn't see it and they weren't ready to give up the practice. And even those who did see it were afraid to speak up often. So today we have to fight modern slavery by speaking up against it consistently and not shying away from it. And I believe we should always use the moral argument. Use any other arguments we have, because they're great. I mean, the fact is that veganism is better for you than vegetarianism. Vegetarianism and veganism are better for you than eating meat. Animal experimentation doesn't get us anywhere. But the bottom line is the principle that might doesn't make right, and that exploitation is wrong, and that discrimination is wrong, and we need to use that. Jennifer Graham was the first student in this country to take on her school and sue her school for the right not to dissect. She didn't win that because there were superior alternatives to dissection. Of course there are, but she won it because she said, I'm not dissecting, I won't do it, it's morally wrong. And she won. And when a Harvard student was asked to do a dog lab, they got the whole of Harvard in the end, took less than a year, to give an option to Harvard medical students, which is now used everywhere, to the dog lab for teaching. And she didn't win because there were sophisticated, better alternatives, which there are. She won because she said, I'm not going to do this. This is immoral. This is repugnant to me. I will not hurt a dog in the process of getting my medical degree. So we have to have hope in what we can accomplish. If we get despondent at how slow the human animal is to learn, we have to look back and know how much has been accomplished and that we can do it. You have to take heart. Everything is changing all over the world. In Catalonia, Spain last year, they banned 14-year-olds and under from going to the bullfighting for moral reasons, because they recognize it's cruel. It's a start. These are all steps, and they're all steps because someone said, I don't think it's right, I'm not going to go along with that. Let me leave you with a few final thoughts. One is that animals are dying without our activism, and so our activism is imperative. There are so many things that move me every day, but one of them is a memo that I saw from the United States Department of Agriculture. It was an internal memo to line inspectors. The line is that thing, you know, that comes along with the animals hanging upside down, going to have their throats slit. And this was a supervisor writing to the line inspectors saying, you may find this hygiene violation, you may find this cruelty, here's what you do, but don't stop the line. And over in capital letters, well, it pointed out all the things that would be wrong that they would find in a slaughterhouse, it said to them, don't stop the line, whatever you do, because the line is money, and you will not stop the line. And I thought, that's what we have to do. That's our goal. Our goal is to stop the line. The second thing I leave you with is the words of Winston Churchill, which I've borrowed. He said, the day may dawn when fair play, love for one's fellows, respect for justice and freedom will enable tormented generations to march forth serene and triumphant from the hideous epoch in which we have to dwell. Meanwhile, never flinch, never weary, and never despair. And last, I borrow from St. Francis of Assisi, not to hurt our humble brethren is our first duty to them, but to stop there isn't enough. We have a higher mission by far. We have to be of service to them whenever they require it. Well, we all know they require it now. Billions and billions and billions of them, and all they have is you and me. So we had better get cracking and do the best job we can to come to their service. A dear Jane Monk friend of mine says, you are the miracle. And it's true. There is nothing else but you. You are the miracle. You have the voice, you have the power, you have the ethics, you have the incentive. You have everything that can change people and can change the world. So all I have to say is, please don't hesitate, don't be embarrassed, don't feel foolish, don't feel intimidated, don't feel anything except strong in your principles. Live your veganism, speak up, speak out. Do everything that you possibly can, and you will change the world. Thank you.